were mainly kids, were so good at doing what every movement tries to do, which is to communicate a critique of the society and to communicate an alternative portrait of how we could live together. It's one of the things that movements do. They try to disrupt, they try to make things stop, but they also try to communicate, partly because they want to influence a broader public, and partly because they're always trying to get more people to join the movement. We have to take from the teachers' strike a new confidence in the capacity of people to see their own power and to act on it.
That's Francis Fox Piven, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Francis Fox Piven on what movements do. The ruling class is organized and well-funded. What can be done to confront and defeat concentrations of power? As a veteran activist once said, organized people can beat organized money. There's a rich history of ordinary people getting together and doing extraordinary things. Take the disability rights movement. Who gave that a chance? Oh, we can't build ramps and put in elevators. It'll cost too much. Or another example is the civil rights movement. African Americans achieved voting rights after overcoming fierce resistance from entrenched white segregationists. There are contemporary movements, such as Black Lives Matter, which protest against police killings of African Americans. Teachers in Arizona, Oklahoma, West Virginia, and elsewhere organized and went on strike and demanded better pay, and they got it. Movements to be effective embody the immortal words of Muhammad Ali: float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Our guest today is Frances Fox Piven. She's a leading activist scholar. She's Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Sociology at the City University of New York. She's the author of numerous books, including Challenging Authority and Lessons for Our Struggle. She spoke at the International Socialist Conference in Chicago. And now, Frances Fox Piven.
Well, but first, I want to say how glad I am to be here. Because it really is a very dark and uncertain moment in American politics, in world politics. And it's a time where the forces of reaction, of cruelty, of imperialism, of war-making are on the move everywhere. And at times like this, we need to be with each other, we need to be on the move, but we need the support and encouragement that we get from standing shoulder to shoulder with people like us. So thank you for being here. You know, it's a very dangerous moment. I probably don't have to put that into words. Everybody knows it. We get up in the morning and we go to our computers to see what horrendous thing has happened since we last looked at the screen or clicked on our phones. I've been around a long time, and I have to say I've never seen a period quite as dismal as this. I don't want to leave it at dismal. Don't worry, I won't. quite as dismal, but also quite as uncertain as this. You know, professionally, I'm a political scientist, and political scientists pretend to be able to show you the patterns in political development which should lead you to understand what's going to happen next. No one knows what's going to happen next. There's a little bit of a glimmering light to that, because it also means that maybe we can affect what happens next. But still, I wouldn't understate how dangerous this moment in American politics, and because we're the most powerful, we're the imperial center of the world, how dangerous this moment is for the entire world, for humankind. And that's important to remember because it makes it more urgent to try to stop the politics that is making it so uncertain and so dangerous. Stopping what's happening has become very, very important, I think. Just think about it. The almost total official power of a right-wing, partially lunatic, but partially incredibly greedy and short-sighted Republican Party now controls the Supreme Court, the presidency, the Congress of the United States. They also control the major branches of a majority of the state governments of the United States. Their control of the court is likely to last for decades. And behind this apparatus of formal power, there are unhinged business interest groups that are on the war path as we have not seen for many decades in the United States. I am talking about fossil fuel interests that are determined to get the stuff out of the ground before global warming and the people destroyed by global warming stop them. They want it now. And I'm also talking about financial chicanery and the banking interests behind financial chicanery that are also, they're on such thin ice that they're not planning for their grandchildren. They want to grab it now, and they are very dangerous. And that dangerousness, that predatory, risk-prone character is reflected in the political apparatus that they sustain and fuel with their money. So we have to stop them. Before we do anything else, we have to stop them. It's a political crisis. And stopping them means, I think, joining with the forces of resistance that are already emerging in the United States and elsewhere. Now, a large part of that resistance is in the movements, you know, all kinds of movements, from Me Too, the Me Too movement. They're not calling themselves socialists, most of them, but some of them are. Some of them are, and some of the people who are trying to move into electoral politics are calling themselves socialists now. But, you know, some people say that the other side of the dark side of the Trump era is, in fact, the strength and vigor of the resistance. And the resistance, with its huge contingent of women, women on the move, this is so encouraging. The resistance is really very important. Perhaps the main thing that we have to rely on to stop them, because we have to stop them before we can reverse the policy changes they've set in motion. Yeah. You know, usually to stop the regime in power and then to build a better society, we need power, don't we? Well, usually when people think about power, they think about power as a result of resources and individual attributes. Power because you're such a good speaker, you're so good looking, You have a whole bunch of money. You can hire and fire a lot of people. You can buy a lot of propaganda. Those are real sources of power. But there's another kind of power that almost never gets mentioned. And that's the kind of power that resides in the cooperative relations of society, in the institutionalized cooperation of society. We live in families, we live in communities, we go to schools, we go to work, we produce things, we have a store, we have a commons. Those are networks of cooperation. The networks of cooperation are not all as pretty as the commons, the school, the family. The networks of cooperation include the biggest businesses, the biggest financial firms that are strangling entire nations. But all of these social institutions are networks of cooperation. And networks of cooperation reach very far into the society. They involve all of us. You get up in the morning, you go get your bagel and coffee. The person who serves you the coffee and toasts the bagel, is cooperating with you. You're giving them money. The nanny is coming, taking care of your children. Now, those are not egalitarian relations, but they are cooperative relations. And they involve everybody. When you went to get the coffee, you had to cross the street. You cooperated by crossing the street at the light. That also was cooperation. And the car drivers cooperated by stopping their cars at the light. Also cooperation. Now, everybody has to cooperate. Or not cooperate, but they also have the ability to not cooperate, to break the rules, to perhaps make demands, have aspirations, to wonder about a better society, and to gather together and refuse to cooperate. Now, from time immemorial, the left has been preoccupied with a form of refusal which illuminates human history. And that form of refusal is the strike. It's collective refusal to cooperate. We think of it as located in industrial mass production. Industrial workers go out on strike. But all sorts of people have the ability to drag their heels and to not cooperate and to collectively not cooperate. You know, I think the most penetrating historians of the Civil War in the United States point to the refusal of plantation slaves to function, to do the economic work on the plantation toward the end of the Civil War as the definitive thrust against the Confederacy. The Union won the war because enslaved Southern blacks refused to cooperate with the plantation economy. So movements do a lot of things. They have banners. We have songs. At this conference, you have great chants. Really great. So movements are a lot of noise. They make noise. They have spectacles. They bring together great crowds of people. And that's what we think of usually when we think of movements. We think of crowds and noise and so forth. But movements also involve this incredible activation of the power of refusal of ordinary people. And that isn't so noisy, necessarily. Sometimes it is. Sometimes there are noisy picket lines, but it can be very quiet. In the 1960s, I worked at a poverty program called Mobilization for Youth on the Lower East Side, and I got to spend a lot of time on the streets and in the community rooms and so forth. And I also had certain obligations and one to the project, and one of them was, I'm a social scientist, was to evaluate what one of their programs was doing, how they were doing it. They had service centers in storefronts, three of them, on the Lower East Side. And in those service centers, there were social workers seated behind wooden tables. And nobody exactly was sure what were the social workers doing. And what the community came into the storefronts, people from the community, and they spoke to the social workers. But we had, you know, we had to do reports to the Ford Foundation or NIMH or whatever on what we were doing. So we made up a little form. And the form asked, well, what did the person come in for and what did you do? It wasn't very sophisticated social science. So the answers were the person came in because they couldn't pay the rent or buy clothing for the kids when school started, and so we helped them get on welfare. Well, we looked at a lot of these forms and we began to wonder why these people who were apparently eligible for welfare, because the social workers got them on welfare, why they weren't on welfare to begin with. And that made us look at survey data from the first the Lower East Side, then New York City, then other cities. And we came to the sort of seat of the pants conclusion that only one out of three of the people eligible for welfare were actually receiving it. So we began to talk to people about organizing welfare recipients, and that put us in touch with a lot of sort of emerging welfare recipient organizations in New York, in Philadelphia, in Cleveland, and other cities in the country. And we proposed that we launch a campaign to demand full benefits from the welfare department. And we had an analysis of why that might work, of the kinds of pressures that such a campaign in the early 1960s would create for the National Democratic Administration. And how those pressures might ricochet up through the federal system. But once you work with people, you form bonds to them, and friendships, and loyalties. I care a lot about the fate of poor women, even especially because I think at that time, women's movement, the second women's movement, was emerging. And it was not a movement of poor women at that point in time. And that really was very important to me, and it was very important to the women in welfare rights who felt rejected by the early feminist movement. There is a tradition on the left which has great confidence in workers and believes that if women on welfare became workers, then they would become politicized members of unions, members of the proletariat, and develop a political capacity that they don't otherwise have. I haven't seen evidence of that. Women on welfare would say, I've been working all my life. And, you know, I think I deserve a break. I deserve a benefit check. I deserve some help raising these kids. Yeah. And, you know, they do try to raise the kids. So for, you know, about 15 years, I was very immersed in the welfare rights movement. And I still have friends that from that period. And I think they were right. And they've suffered since that time. They and the people who, in a sense, replaced them in the ranks of the poor, of the American poor, the treatment of the poor since the 1960s, since they were really on the march, since they were politicized, since they, once, after they began to think that they had rights and that they could occupy welfare centers to fight for those rights. There was, of course, a backlash, just as there was for the larger black freedom movement, because the welfare rights movement was only part of the black freedom movement, after all. And the backlash meant that people were smashed down when they tried to make demands, that they were isolated from each other. But most horrible, they were demeaned and ridiculed by presidents of the United States, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and even Bill Clinton. This is truly irresponsible leadership. And not only were they berated and denigrated with language from the White House, but there was cut after cut to the programs on which they depended. One of the achievements of the welfare rights movement, not just of the welfare rights movement, also of the larger black freedom movement, but one of their achievements was they forced the liberalization of the program known as AFDC, welfare. So benefits rose. The staff in welfare centers became somewhat more courteous and efficient. People were armed by their own sense of rights and by the fact that they had lawyers, too, from the welfare rights movement. But once the movement subsided, of course, the cuts began to roll in. Not only the nasty ways of talking about poor people, poor women trying to raise a bevy of kids on their own, but the cuts and the forced work programs and the range of ways to humiliate these women. I don't know if any of you remember how in New York City, when Rudolph Giuliani, you know, he hasn't always been Trump's lawyer, when he was the mayor of New York, he presided over the implementation in New York of the Personal Responsibility Act, which was welfare reform, but it was really welfare cuts. And the form that welfare cuts took is that, one form it took is that women were assigned to work crews in city government in New York. And, you know, they were made to wear day-glow vests as they worked on the side of roads or in the parks. What was that about? I think that was just like the denigration of welfare recipients of paupers in medieval England, where if people asked for a handout, they were tied to carts on market day. Or they were branded. I mean, this is a form of public humiliation. And our political leaders have been doing that to poor people since the 1960s, really. Back in the 1960s, there were people who, associated with Commentary magazine, who, neocons in other words, There were people who were very angry at intellectuals who supported the black movement. And their argument was that the United States under the leadership of the Democratic Party, not the New Deal Democratic Party anymore, but a much chastened and worn out Democratic Party without unions, that the United States was becoming a social democracy. And what was really dangerous and interrupting that progression was the Black Freedom Movement. Now, they couldn't scold blacks because they would be hooted at, but they could scold white intellectuals who supported the Black movement. I've heard people say that Occupy Wall Street failed. You know, I think that's a really wacky thing to say. Occupy Wall Street, well, it was a relatively small action. A few hundred people in a park. And there, I've been to a lot of Occupies in other cities too, and they were all like that, relatively small, very nice, very friendly, and very talented. These kids, and they were mainly kids, were so good at doing what every movement tries to do, which is to communicate a critique of the society and to communicate an alternative portrait of how we could live together. It's one of the things that movements do. They try to disrupt, they try to make things stop, but they also try to communicate, partly because they want to influence a broader public, and partly because they're always trying to get more people to join the movement. Occupy was so good at doing this. Come on, can't you remember how they changed political discourse in the United States? How many times have we written for little newspapers and for big newspapers and tried to change the discourse? That's what we always say we're doing. I've written so many books. Occupy had a much bigger impact on the public discourse than I did. Everybody knows what the 1% and the 99% are. Now, it's true that Occupy didn't do the whole job by any means. They had to get bigger, there had to be more people in the movement, and we had to make more trouble. We had to use our different kinds of strike power. But one group can't do everything, and we can't do it all at once. So there's much more to be done, and we're going to go on to do it, I think.
I would love your thoughts on the revival of the strike, and particularly in these, you know, so-called red states, and we're seeing these teacher strikes ripple across the country.
Well, I loved it. I was so cheered by it. So what lessons can we take from it? I think there are a couple. One is the teachers' unions did not organize the strike. We have to take the lesson of mass, unorganized, relatively, we call it spontaneous. It's not really spontaneous. It's just an official organization isn't doing it. But we have to take from the teachers' strike a new confidence in the capacity of people to see their own power and to act on it. And even in a red state.
You're listening to Frances Fox Piven on What Movements Do. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
But there's another lesson, I think. You know, the old left has always placed its confidence in industrial workers, workers in the mass production industries. The great blow that globalization struck to the labor movement was that globalization meant that investment in mass production could shift to low-wage parts of the globe. Everybody knows that problem. It was devastating, devastating for the industrial unions. And even though I'm critical for unions, I think we're much better off with unions. But notice who struck. It was teachers. And notice also how militant the nurses are. So even though they tell us, old-timers who want to discourage a youthful movement, they tell us that, and I've heard labor leaders say this, we can't talk about striking now. It's not quite true. We have to be careful when we talk about striking. We have to figure out who can strike. Who can't be replaced by a computer message that sends investment to Bangladesh? And that is teachers, nurses, all kinds of service workers, the nannies that take care of the kids, of the women who work now on Wall Street. A lot of people can't be replaced with the click of a computer. So it's not quite true that the workers' movement can't survive globalization and internationalization. It's just that we have to adapt in our strategies to the constraints and the opportunities created by globalization. And I said opportunities because I think that globalization also creates opportunities. Globalization means extended chains of production. Things are produced everywhere and they have to be coordinated. There's a very fragile system of transportation and coordination through computer programs. And think about the huge warehouse centers where all this stuff is dumped. And then it has to be fed out over the country, over highways and complicated systems of truck transportation. This is a very fragile system. You know, in the old days, labor leaders used to talk about logistical workers. Yep. They were very interested in logistical workers. Logistical workers were like dockers. They worked in the port, because they could jam things up in the port. Now there are a lot of places where you can jam things up, and we've got to learn how to do that.
So I'm keeping an eye on the clock here, because I know are going to have some questions from the room, but I wanted to ask also, since we were talking about poor people's movements, the new poor people's campaign that has just been kicking off.
Well, I take great cheer from the emergence of that movement. I have one observation about it. People sort of wonder why the poor aren't protesting right away, because of course they're the ones that feel the crunch of austerity politics first. And the reason is because they're most vulnerable. That's why. So one of the reasons that we should support protest movements elsewhere in the society is that it spreads, it gives people courage, it gives the poor courage. And we should also work with their movements. We should join their movements. I think we should join the Poor People's Campaign and support it with donations too.
Two questions. Three words. Yippies and the role that they bring to a movement with that kind of disruption. Guaranteed income, how does capital work? What does that mean? Is it good or bad in your opinion?
I've been an advocate of guaranteed income or basic income. It's got different names. I've also been very aware of the way some people on the left leery of guaranteed income or basic income. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that the left historically has always thought that power, the power of the working class, stemmed from the fact that they worked, that they had jobs. And because they had jobs, they could go on strike. Because they had jobs, they could organize in the first instance. They were brought together under one roof. And they could also go on strike and wield leverage against capital. That's one criticism. And the other criticism is the fear that a guaranteed income would lead to the wiping out of other social support programs and replace them with an inadequate guaranteed income. I think that it's possible that that could happen. That depends on the kind of guaranteed income program we legislate. We could do that with anything. We could decide that we'll have a guaranteed income program of $10 a month or something of that sort. But that's true also of unemployment benefits, Social Security. All of those programs are defined not only by the introductory sentence in the legislation, but they're also defined by the specific amounts of resources that are allocated to the program and the administrative method for distributing the benefits, whether the benefits are a matter of right, whether they can easily be defended, understood and defended by the recipients of the benefits. There are many features of the benefit system that matter in making good on the promise. Now, as for the idea that only workers have power, that the main source of popular power is through work. Well, I've been talking about that all evening, in effect. I think there are other sources of power by working people. The interdependence of society has to be examined and acted on. And if we don't see other kinds of power, it's because they don't want us to see those other kinds of power. Working people had to discover the power of the strike. And the power of the strike also exists in many other institutional settings.
I really just want your advice, because I'm a direct action organizer with the Poor People's Campaign. So I really want to know, really, like, tell me, what do I need to bring back to make happen? Because you got it.
All right, so here's what I think we have to kind of figure out. But first I want to say that I love this campaign. I think the moral face that it's putting forward is absolutely right. It moves people everywhere, but it especially moves poor people. I was just a couple of days ago at a rally in Kingston, New York, about family separation, where a Catholic priest addressed the largely Hispanic crowd, and he was so eloquent, but what the eloquence had a lot to do with his drawing on the Judeo-Christian moral tradition to talk about the travesty of ripping children, babies, away from their parents. And I think the Poor People's Campaign can tap the same kind of moral outrage. But what I think that any campaign has to also do, that they have to do what the welfare rights movement did, which is they have to figure out a set of concrete actions that their followers can take that have the effect of disrupting service agencies and making trouble for those agencies. What the welfare rights movement did was it occupied welfare centers. Now, it had certain advantages. The Roxbury, Massachusetts welfare rights movement occupied a welfare center in Roxbury at a time when there was rioting on the streets. And the women yelled out to the streets for support But, you know, there's a lot going on in this country now. There's a lot of anger in this country now. We can get a lot of supporters if we begin to raise the issues, the moral issues, of how the richest country in the United States is also the country with the most extreme inequality and the most brutal poverty of any OECD nation.
So I'm really, really glad you brought up this sort of cultural critique of Occupy, that it failed. Because I think that what most people's critique is that it failed on an organizational level, that it was due to the fact that they operated on a consensus model, and they had these long, seemingly horrendous meetings that lasted all the way into the night, and then one person would say, I think this is the wrong idea, and we're just going to talk about it all again tomorrow. That was part of why it failed.
I wouldn't say that the main problem with Occupy was the endless meetings and the consensus model. But, I mean, it was a problem. And people come together for action, for collective action, and they want to be effective. And I think that Occupy, in that sense, did not succeed. But, you know, most of us don't succeed in most of the things we try to do. Occupy was enormously successful in what it did. So let's appreciate that and go on from there.
Okay. I want to emphasize how radical intellectuals change discourse. What you have contributed to the social movements is, to me, foundational in the sense that actually theorizing in a scientific way the way that movements, especially movements of the working class, can actually change, transform politics.
One thing that matters in you is you have to have respect for the people you want to work with. And not just preach to them about what you think they should do. That just won't work. And in order to have that respect, I can only speak now about myself. I mean, I was completely in love with the movements of the 1960s and 70s. And that was my life. It was much more important to me than anything else I did. And you know, I made sacrifices for that, but didn't feel like sacrifices because it was what I cared about. And, you know, a lot of people think that they can dabble in movement work while aiming to get tenure and things like that. Well, maybe you can a little. Some people can, but you miss the experience.
One of the questions my colleagues and I are engaging a lot with recently related to social movements literature is what constitutes the idea of success? What is victory? I think scholars at this point generally concede that a movement usually fails in one way and succeeds in another. People often don't create the sort of bifurcation definitionally of what it is for an academic to consider success and what it means to be, you know, on the picket lines and talking about what success feels like or looks like to you.
There isn't a simple answer to that question, or I don't have a simple answer. I think you need to have multiple criteria for success. Perhaps one criteria would be to measure responses against the demands of the protesters. But there are other criteria that in a way are more elusive and subtle. I have a very dear organizer friend who pointed out to me once, many years ago, that people don't care as much about losing as they care about being defeated, deflated. So the impact of the action on the morale of the movement and the people in the movement is also very important. And then, of course, in time, we have the question of success in a longer-term perspective, how short-term victories are distorted, co-opted, yeah. withdrawn. We want to know we want that kind of evaluation too. So we need a complex measure of success. And different participants will have different measures of success as well. ISO may have a measure of political consciousness and how it changed as a consequence of the action. And that's a legitimate question. So we have to complicate the question and complicate the answer. And academics are very good at that.
So I'm just wondering from you, someone who's been involved in politics and activism a lot longer than me, how you've been able to manage, you know, these feelings of dread, horror, whether from your intellectual, political realizations, but also, you know, from the experience in your personal life of this country and capitalism, and maybe in relationship to the title of the talk, you know, in being rebellious, how you channel that in either like an emotional or even spiritual way to keep doing your work where you're still here in front of us and just being amazing. So give me some insight, just your...
Have good friends. And go to ISO meetings.
So in terms of all our projects and the questions people were asking, I mean, I'm just reminded of you know, the original Poor People's Campaign, I Am a Man, the sanitation worker strike, right, in Memphis, right? These links have been there historically. I'd love to hear from you if you have any more little tidbits about labor and welfare recipients or the Poor People's Campaign sort of coming together in that way. And just to put that out to everybody, to be aware of how we can bring those parts of the movement together.
Well, there was a lot of division between workers and poor people in the 1960s, between a largely white working class, often unionized, and black working people and black poor people and Hispanic poor people. A lot of animus. And often you had to choose sides. I know in principle we want the workers and the... and because after all, I always said that people on welfare are part of the working class. There's no question about that. And if there were any question, well, we've been putting them to work, haven't we? So they're part of the working class. But people's consciousness and the identities that they cherish and use in a way that is antagonistic to other members of the working class are there. They're there. Sometimes I think I at least felt that I had to stand with welfare recipients against workers. I remember one particular event where we blocked the doors and working class people came and kicked me in the shin. So,
and I think we will go with our last question.
I'm a retired New York City train operator from Brooklyn, TWU Local 100. And you mentioned Rudy Giuliani and his, what was it, the Personal Responsibility Program?
The Personal Responsibility Act was the name of the federal legislation.
Well, we had something that was probably part of that called the Work Experience Program. And I think
it was part of the same tendency,
How that worked, at least in transit. Now, first of all, the union saw that for what it was just a way to get cheap labor for the MTA. These folks were generally assigned to being station cleaners. They worked alongside of our union station cleaners. The union felt that those jobs should be filled by union members, which I agree with. But even though they work alongside of the our union members, they had completely separate facilities. They were banned from our break rooms. They were banned from the toilets. Everything that we used, they were banned from. And they had their own separate but not terribly equal facilities for them. And that, I thought, was a bit harsh. But the real kicker was that these folks, I think they had to work 30 hours a week. This is part of that act. They also, these were single mothers and everything, so this took up their whole life. And they had a time limit, the welfare time limit. So they would get put in this program, they worked full time, essentially, for the whole, I think, was it 9 months or something? What was the limit in those days for the welfare? And when their welfare ran out, they were not only out of welfare, but out of a job, because they would just got kicked off the program, and there was no place for them to go within transit or anything like that. So one more thing, very quickly, that I think is kind of ironic. A comrade here mentioned about the interminable meetings of the Occupy Wall Street police. Well, it turns out that the venue for those meetings, I think, was the public spaces of the Goldman Sachs building.
The public-private spaces, yeah.
You know, in order to get their building built, they had to dedicate certain areas in New York, and I just thought that was kind of ironic.
Thank you for that comment. So I want to say, I wish the entire labor movement was like Local 100.
That was Frances Fox Piven on What Movements Do. She spoke at the International Socialist Conference in Chicago. Frances Fox Piven is a leading activist scholar. She's Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Sociology at the City University of New York. She's the author of many books, including Challenging Authority and Lessons for Our Struggle. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Chris Hedges, Ralph Nader, Barbara Ehrenreich, Tariq Ali, Angela Davis, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Natalie Merchant singing, "Which Side Are You On?"
Which side are you on, boys? Which side?